Nice to see everyone here. That was everybody. The coffee's kind of kicking in. Good morning. Great. I want to clarify that I actually am not a doctor, in spite of Irene's attempt to confer an honorary degree on me this morning. I also want to acknowledge that this room setup is a little funky, and ideally I think we would want to be closer to our slides. There's a funny kind of tennis match thing happening. So if you have to choose, look at me. It makes me feel better than looking at but I'll try and pause so that you can capture both. I actually want to start, I have no relationships to disclose, personal or professional, with a couple of anecdotes I hope will illustrate kind of the rest of what I'm going to talk about quickly. The first comes from, many of you may be aware, some of you may not, that there are actually other cities in the Bay Area, and there's one in which I live and work, Oakland, across the Bay. You should come and visit if you have time. Asian Health Services is a community-based healthcare provider in Oakland, and about 8 or 9 years ago, they became aware of some issues among pedestrians in the Chinatown neighborhood of Oakland. In particular, a relative of a prominent board member was killed while crossing a street at an intersection close to the one you see here. And they looked at the data, and they realized that they had actually an abnormally high rate of injuries and fatalities, particularly among their senior citizen population, from interactions between pedestrians, bicyclists, and automobiles. Chinatown is you know, as you can see, kind of broad streets. It's a big thoroughfare, lots of goods traveling. And so it's a long story, but the clinic essentially realized that they kind of had a choice to make. They could either continue to treat people who were injured when they came into the clinic doors, or they could think about what was actually going on outside their doors in the community. So they got involved. They formed partnerships, worked with Department of Public Works, got some foundation money, et cetera, and did a number of things. One, you can see here, this is called a scramble intersection. So they created these intersections where when the lights stop, they stop in all directions. You can cross any way you want. These are heavily trafficked areas. They looked at signage in the neighborhood. They looked at truck routing and so forth, got involved in land use decision making. Great. They were able to document a reduction in injuries and deaths among pedestrians in the neighborhood. Totally makes sense. And this is great, and I highlight this, one, because they're an institution that actually had the kind of vision and partnership, so they were able to do this. But two, the thing that really strikes me about this is that none of this work was paid for by healthcare dollars. They had to find other sources of money in order to do this kind of work. And it makes perfect sense, right? If you're seeing people injured in your community, well, you should think about what's actually going on. But they were only able to do that because of these other resources. The second anecdote is about a dear friend of mine who's a doctor. And we've had kind of conversations over the years about our work and kind of comparing our experiences. And mostly it's him making fun of me for what he calls the squishiness of public health. So many of you may have that experience. But we had a conversation a few years ago where he was working part-time in a private clinic in the suburbs and part-time in a public clinic in inner city San Francisco. And he was really wrestling with the experience he was having in these two places. The way he described it was, well, you know, in the private clinic, I feel so capable. Kids come in, their parents come in, I have answers. They're the things I was trained to do. And he contrasted that with his experience in the public clinic where he said he felt like he was at a loss. He was constantly searching for answers and trying to understand the problems that he was being faced with. And initially he thought this might have to do with sort of cultural issues and that he really wasn't understanding his patients. But he thought about that a little bit and realized that really he had great relationships with the parents that he was seeing. The problem was that the issues they were dealing with were much different than those of the issues in the suburban context, right? Instead of dealing with sort of immunizations and, you know, kids having bacterial infections, he was dealing with kids who were, you know, who had asthma, had issues. They were witnessing violence in their community and were showing signs of mental health issues at young ages, pre-diabetes, et cetera. And these were issues that he really didn't have tools to deal with. This is a quote from a doctor here in San Francisco, Laura Gottlieb, who said, "I diagnosed abdominal pain when the real problem was hunger. I confused social issues with medical problems in other patients, too. I had neither the skills nor the resources for treating them. I ignored the social context of disease altogether." And if you're interested in these issues, actually, Laura Gottlieb has just founded an organization with a couple of other doctors called Health Begins to create a community of clinicians who are looking at these issues. So, you know, it's not surprising that these issues of kind of behavioral, environmental context and impact on health are coming up, right? If you look at all of the research, we see that behaviors and environment determine health to the greatest degree, 70%, 20% genetics, 10% access to medical care. There's lots of different studies and different numbers, but this is kind of an approximation of where you come out. And then you look at where we spend our healthcare dollars. So $2.7 trillion, and about 3% of that is going towards prevention. And we think about the sorts of strategies that are going to impact those behaviors and environments. It's in that 3%. And of that 3%, the majority of that is going to clinical services, screenings, immunizations, important stuff, but very little going to the kinds of things that Asian Health Services was doing or that Laura Gottlieb is pointing towards. You know, in sort of thinking about how to systematically understand the relationship between the health outcomes we're seeing and the environmental conditions, we've created this at Prevention Institute, this framework we call Two Steps to Prevention. I'm going to go through this super quick given the time, but I'm happy to talk about it more with anybody who's interested. Most people, if you ask them about health and sort of what's important to health, and this is not true for this audience, of course, we'll talk about health services. Quality of the doctors, access, et cetera. And super important, I mean, I think all the issues that were brought up in the previous presentation are really important for us to resolve. Where, you know, how to align payment in a more effective way, cultural competence, access to care, all those issues. But it's also important to look deeper and to understand how that person ended up in this emergency room. So, again, many of you, I'm sure, are very familiar with the work that McGinnis and Fagey did in the 90s looking at death certificates and articulating a set of actual causes of death. So when you look at the death certificate, it says heart disease, but what's really going on? They track this back to 9 actual causes. 3 of them are listed here, diet and activity, tobacco, alcohol, and drugs. And this is a really incredibly important shift, right? We reframe the problem from one that has solely a set of healthcare solutions to one where there's a broader set of potential solutions. And as we deal with diet and activity patterns, we're also addressing multiple health outcomes simultaneously. And then there's this next step, to understand from those exposures and behaviors, what are the environmental factors that are shaping people's physical activity levels, their access to tobacco and alcohol, et cetera. We've done some work with the Office of Minority Health to develop kind of a comprehensive framework of community health factors. These are them. I'm not going to go through them in any detail. But it's sort of a menu to choose from to understand, because this is going to be different in every community. If there's, you know, if you're looking at physical activity rates, well, what is it? Is it about the sort of feelings of safety? Is it access to parks? Is it that the air isn't healthy, et cetera? I hesitated to put this slide in because I thought it might make everybody nervous given the timing. But I put it in because, you know, I think it's important to realize that this isn't just a sort of conceptual shift towards prevention. There's actually a political and pragmatic shift going on. So as President Obama said, simply put, in the absence of a radical shift towards prevention in public health, we will not be successful in containing medical costs or improving the health of the American people. We looked at the Affordable Care Act, and there are a couple of things that stand out immediately from a kind of prevention public health perspective. There's the Prevention Public Health Fund. There's the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Innovation. But then we started looking at some of the other pieces and thinking about, well, so how does prevention fit into this more broadly? So, you know, as you just heard in the presentation before me about patient-centered health homes, medical homes, and a lot of that focuses on kind of internal practice. How do we set up healthcare institutions to be more effective, to be more coordinated? And we started to think about, well, what would it look like if a healthcare institution was set up to be focused on the community simultaneously, both deliver that quality care, but also connect what they're doing in a clinical context with what's happening outside the community, You know, so we wrote a report that I have a few copies of, if anybody's interested, of delineating this. And we realized in doing this is not a new idea. Many of you also may be steeped in the history of the community clinic movement. This is Drs. Geiger and Hatch in Mississippi as they were opening one of these clinics. And Jack Geiger got in a lot of trouble from the the bureaucrats who were overseeing this program when he stocked the pharmacy at one of these clinics with food. And he testified before Congress and said, well, you know, the last time we looked in the book, this is the physician's disc reference, the specific therapy for malnutrition was food. Sensible, right? He also prescribed shoes for children who had hookworm and ended up getting in a lot of trouble when he tried to pass off tractors as medical equipment. That was kind of where the line got drawn. But there's a history of this sort of work. So as we, talk to experts around the country, visited with clinics, we saw a real pattern emerging in terms of the sorts of activities along the lines of sort of engaging at a community level. And it's actually parallel in a lot of ways to a clinician's process in dealing with an individual patient. So a clinician sees a patient, there's an intake collection of information, they provide a diagnosis, and then they develop a treatment plan. So as we looked at the activity across the country, what we saw was actually that there are three parallel steps, which we named inquiry, analysis, and action. So inquiry, let's skip ahead, is all about kind of painting the picture of what's going on. So how is a clinic do you collect information, right? So, you know, on those intake forms when you walk in and you have to fill out your medical history and et cetera, are there questions about social conditions? You know, do you feel safe in your neighborhood? What's the quality of your housing? Those sorts of questions. And second, those all kind of relate it back to these thrive factors, all the sorts of things in a community that could be shaping health. There's also this moment in the clinical encounter where doctors are sort of asking questions, and there are examples where there are prompts put in place so that a child comes in with asthma, and the doctor automatically asks, "So what's your housing situation like? Where's your school located?" These sorts of factors. Anybody in your household smoke? So, and then how do you capture that information? So there are these multiple different opportunities for kind of capturing getting a good picture of what's going on. Next is analysis. So what do you do with this information once you have it? One is to look at trends. So the Asian Health Services, again, they saw this trend in pedestrian safety data. Many of you may have seen some of the work that's going on in Camden, New Jersey around hot spotting. This is Tuul Gawande featured in a New Yorker piece and has gotten a lot of resonance. You know, how do you look at data to establish patterns and look where there's the greatest need and the greatest impact on populations? And how do you bring in partners to have that conversation? Right? Clinics have one piece of the data, but often they don't have the complete data set. So how do you establish the sorts of partnerships that are necessary to understand that, okay, if we're seeing X, we're seeing a rise in what we perceive to be children experiencing violence in the community. Well, who do we need to talk to understand what's really going on? And next is what sort of action can we take? So one is to look at the sort of organizational practices of the institution. This is Kaiser Permanente that's gotten very involved in the farmers market movement in California. I think they're up to 29 farmers markets on their premises across the state. Roles as advocates for community health for specific issues. The picture on the right here is effort to close liquor stores in South Los Angeles that clinicians were very involved in. And how do you work with your partners and establish effective partnerships? This is a tool called Collaboration Multiplier that's used for generating intersectoral partnerships. So to kind of put these pieces together and in kind of a real-world context, I want to talk for a minute about the St. John's Well Child Family Center in Los Angeles. So this is about 6 years ago or 7 years ago, clinicians at St. John's noticed a rise in kind of a cluster of health conditions, rashes, asthma, cockroaches in kids' ears, which is gruesome. Apparently, cockroaches can't back up. This is what they told me. The kind of stuff you notice if you're a clinician and you're treating, particularly you're a pediatrician treating children. And they looked at all of these things and they said, well, this seems like there's something going on here that relates to housing. So they initially put in some questions into their intake questionnaire about housing conditions to get a little better picture. It's, again, a long story. They partnered with a number of other community organizations, tenants' rights organizations, city departments, and they went after landlords. And they did that both through legal channels and also through their through public relations channels. So they produced a report. There was a series in local paper on the impact of landlord negligence on children and the broad impact that that has. Again, they're able to document a broad set of improvements in health due to this action, due to improving landlord compliance. So that's kind of the framework that we came up with. And I want to take just my last minute and a half to talk quickly about where we're going from here. This is kind of 1.0, and now we're moving into 2.0 and trying to better understand how to actually do this and how we can provide support, technical assistance to clinical institutions that kind of want to move in this direction, make this transformation. So there are four things I want to talk about really quickly. Training, data, pay for health, and effective partnerships. So training and capacity building both among internal staff, we're seeing actually a rise in the number of medical schools that are including coursework and residencies on social determinants and health, how to work with community partners, et cetera. Data and analysis, how to share data, how to use internal data. The chart here is very difficult to see. It's from Cincinnati Children's Hospital, but they started collecting data on asthma rates by zip code. And as a result of that, actually, similarly to St. John's, identified a couple of landlords who had places across the city in different neighborhoods. They were actually kind of able to connect the dots and recognize that it was these two different landlords who were really the worst culprits in terms of housing issues. And negligence. The big question is, how do you pay for all of this? So we're looking at models to pay for health instead of pay for services. There are a number of really exciting innovations here around accountable care organizations. Massachusetts recently passed a wellness trust, so pulling a small tax on insurers to pay for population health activity. There's some interesting work around community benefits and their new requirements on public hospitals. And also we're looking at social impact bonds and health impact bonds as a market-based way to generate funds. And I'm, again, glad to talk more about any of those with folks afterwards. And lastly is effective partnerships. You know, there's this really key opportunity for health care institutions to become kind of a part of a broader community-wide effort to improve health and to establish effective partnerships that both indicate when trend lines are going up and also facilitate effective action over time. So let me stop. This is my last thing I'll say, is this quote from Jack Geiger to wrap up. You can do more than bail out these medical disasters after they have occurred. Go upstream from medical care to forge instruments of social change that will prevent such disasters from occurring in the first place. And this is our website if you want some more info.